From Pacifica, this is Democracy Now!
In light of the unfortunate, tragic death of Sean Bell on November 25th, we in the community of Southeast Queens are hopeful that the District Attorney, Richard Brown, will conduct an impartial investigation that will lead to the indictment of the guilty police officers.
A major march is planned for Saturday in New York to protest the death of Sean Bell, an unarmed man gunned down in a hail of 50 police bullets on the day of his wedding. We'll speak with Bishop Erskine Williams, and in a Democracy Now! Exclusive, we show Port Authority footage that shows passengers and police diving for cover as one of the bullets hits the train tracks above. And we'll take a look at the over 1,000 undocumented workers swept up in a Homeland Security raid. All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. President Bush is preparing to seek about $100 billion in emergency funds for the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan. The figure was disclosed in a report prepared by the staffers on the House Appropriations Committee and House Budget Committee. The $100 billion would come on top of the record $447 billion already appropriated for military operations this year. In Washington, Democratic Senator Tim Johnson of South Dakota has been hospitalized with an undisclosed illness. He's said to be in critical condition. Aides said he had exhibited symptoms of a stroke. Johnson's illness may have political ramifications for the Democrats' slim Senate majority. If Johnson is forced to give up his seat, South Dakota Governor, Republican Mike Rounds, would choose his replacement. If Rounds were to choose a Republican, that would mean a 50-50 tie in the Senate. That would hand effective control back to the Republicans because Vice President Dick Cheney would hold the tie-breaking vote. In Chile, the grandson of the late dictator Augusto Pinochet has been discharged from the army over his public defense of the coup that brought his grandfather to power. Captain Augusto Pinochet Molina made the comment during his speech at his grandfather's funeral. Earlier Wednesday, Chilean President Michelle Bachelet called Molina's words unacceptable.
During the ceremony, an official overstepped the line of command without authorization to speak, abruptly expressing political opinions against the state and certain sectors of society. This constitutes a grave insult. We're sure that the army will know what its duty is.
Pinochet died on Sunday on International Human Rights Day. During his time of rule, the Chilean government murdered or disappeared more than 3,200 people. Tens of thousands were also tortured. At the UN, the General Assembly has adopted a landmark treaty to uphold the rights of the disabled. The Convention on the Rights of Persons with Disabilities has been hailed the first human rights treaty of the 21st century. This is UN Deputy Secretary General Mark Malik Brown.
Today promises, we hope, to be the dawn of a new era where disabled people will no longer have to endure the discriminatory practices and attitudes that have been permitted to prevail for all too long. This convention is a remarkable and forward-looking document. While it focuses on the rights and development of people with disabilities, it also speaks about our societies as a whole and about the need to enable every person to contribute to the best of their abilities and potentials.
In other UN news, the Human Rights Council voted Wednesday to send a high-level delegation to probe Darfur's worsening humanitarian crisis. This is Algerian ambassador to the UN, Idriss Jazari.
This is the message of hope for the people of Africa. This is a message of hope for the people of the world. I think we have risen to our responsibilities.
In Botswana, the High Court has ruled more than 1,000 Bushmen were wrongly evicted from their ancestral grounds. In 2002, Botswana's government readied the Kalahari Desert for diamond mining by pushing out the San, who are the oldest inhabitants of southern Africa and live in the central Kalahari Game Reserve. Back in the United States, The Washington Post is reporting details of a newly released Pentagon report that warned three terrorism suspects were subjected to months of isolation in possible violation of U.S. law. In one interrogation plan approved by the Joint Forces Command, a Qatari detainee was denied sleep and religious practice by having his mattress, pillow, and Quran taken away. In at least one case, jailers blocked the International Committee of the Red Cross from visiting the prisoners. The disclosure comes as lawyers for the imprisoned Jose Padilla are seeking court approval to access documents and interview interrogators about Padilla's treatment. And finally, former Enron chief executive Jeffrey Skilling reported to federal prison Wednesday to begin a 24-year sentence for his role in one of the nation's largest corporate scandals. Skilling was convicted on 19 counts of conspiracy, fraud, and insider trading. His sentence is the longest of any former employee linked to the Enron scandal. And those are some of the headlines. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org. Heartbreaker, Rolling Stones, here on Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez. We begin today's show with a Democracy Now! Broadcast exclusive. We air for the first time surveillance footage connected to the shooting of Sean Bell. Bell was the unarmed African-American man killed by undercover police in a hail of 50 bullets in Queens, New York, 2 weeks ago. He died hours before he was supposed to be married, and two of his friends were seriously wounded. This footage is from two surveillance cameras at the Port Authority's Jamaica Avenue Air Train Station, which is a half a block away from the shooting site. The video reveals that one of the bullets fired by the five cops narrowly missed striking a civilian and two Port Authority patrolmen who were standing on the station's elevated platform. One video shows a bullet shattering a window in the station and then nearly hitting the man. The second video shows two police officers scrambling for cover inside the station after the shot was fired. The content of the video was first revealed in the New York Daily News by Democracy Now! Co-host Juan Gonzalez, but it has never been aired before. In a moment, we'll be joined by Bishop Erskine Williams. He's the bishop of the New Seasons Family Worship Center in Queens and a pastor for the families of Sean Bell's two injured friends. But first, we turn to co-host Juan Gonzalez. Juan, explain the significance of this video footage.
Well, I think one of the things it shows, number one, is that there were a lot more people endangered that night by this shooting, the 50-shot barrage of the police officers at the scene, five cops at the scene, plainclothes and undercover. There had been a report that there had been at least one errant bullet, and I think Graham Witherspoon, when he was on the show, also talked about one that went into a home and hit a lamp. But it turns out that this particular bullet that went to the air train, which
and
was...
And this is the train to the plane, to Kennedy Airport.
Yes, the Port Authority's train to the plane. And the Jamaica station is right down Liverpool Street where the shooting occurred, about half a block away from the shooting. And also, it's an elevated station. So these bullets were had to travel from the ground up, considerably up in the air, to reach the platform of the elevated station. And the video that was made available to me by a source shows as a Port Authority police two cameras, and it shows, as we saw in the video, that one elderly gentleman with his luggage was the bullet almost hit him in the head, because you actually see the trail of the bullet shattering the glass and right at the eye level of the man right in front of him. And he drops his luggage and runs, and the two Port Authority police nearby scampered away. One actually has filed for a line of duty injury. And the commonest person in the video is apparently a Transportation Safety Agency employee who's also waiting for the train, I guess, to go, a TSA agent, to go to Kennedy. And he hears the shots, and he turns calmly around and looks to see what's happening. But everyone else is terrified on the train, including the two police who thought they were being attacked. They then radioed to their command that they were being fired upon because they were not on the same radio frequency as the police department, so they had no idea what was going on just downstairs.
And you see them running down, and then one slips and
falls.
Right,
one slips and falls. He's the one who filed for a line of duty injury as a result of his slip, yes.
For our radio listeners, you can go to our website at democracynow.org, and you will be able to see the footage that we have been describing right now. Again, from two vantage points, two Port Authority cameras.
Cameras that were on the platform, yes.
Juan, you're also have been reporting about, and there is a police report on the so-called fourth person.
Right. Well, I reported in the Daily News this week that there's been a lot of talk ever since the shooting that there was allegedly a fourth person who tried to either get into or out of Sean Bell's car just before police opened fire, and who may have had a gun. And in fact, for a while, police sources were actually identifying someone they'd picked up as, quote, the fourth man. Because this would be very important, because if there was a fourth person with a gun, then the police officers who fired would have more justification for this incredible number of shots that they fired if they thought they were really being attacked by someone with a gun. Well, I reported in the Daily News that all of the radio dispatches that were issued that night immediately after the shooting by the police at the scene, the cops who fired, as well as the conversations between authorities, never mentioned the fourth man, never mentioned someone with a gun had escaped from the scene. The police never conducted a manhunt for a fourth man. So that this, quote, fourth man really developed subsequently. But at the scene, which is the most important time for any investigator, the moments after an event like this, nobody ever mentioned a fourth man. And in addition, there were all kinds of communications lapses among the nine cops, because there were a total of nine plainclothes and undercover cops at the scene.
Plainclothes cops in the Kahlua nightclub where Sean and his two friends were having a bachelor party.
Right. There was a bachelor party going on, and there was actually a surveillance team. Not all of the police went into the club. Total of three, according to the police reports, entered the club at any one time. And the others were backup teams that were supposed to come in if they had found any illegal activity, conducted any arrests. There was a backup van to hold prisoners, and that was the van that actually collided with Sean Bell's car. So that there was a total of nine police officers at the scene total, but there were communications lapses between them. One of them, with two female officers, when the shooting started, actually traveled quite a bit of distance away from the scene and were totally were
oblivious to all of
it? Well, it was, they didn't know what was going on. They were lost. They couldn't tell the radio dispatchers where they were, the exact location of where they were. So there were all kinds of problems with the management and the operation of that team, apparently, from the initial reports that I've been able to briefed on.
We are now joined by Bishop Erskine Williams. He's Bishop of the New Seasons Family Worship Center and pastor for the Benefield and Guzman families. He himself had his own sons rounded up in the days after the Bell shooting. We welcome you to Democracy Now!
Thank you. It's my pleasure.
As you watched this video for the first time, what were your thoughts?
It's reprehensible, appalling, disgusting to see that if an incident occurred on the ground, why shots being fired overhead, which somewhat gives me to understand at the meeting that we had at City Hall with the mayor and the police commissioner. Police Commissioner Kelly made mention of the fact that this particular unit is allowed to have two drinks on the job. And I raised the issue, who's monitoring the fact whether they have two drinks or 10 drinks? Who's to say it's beer as opposed to vodka? It would leave one to believe that they may have been inebriated. If they're trained to shoot at a target, it wasn't overhead. So there's a lot of questions that need to be answered.
And also, could you talk about the experiences that have occurred with your own sons? Because I think one of the big criticisms of many leaders in the black community is that even subsequent to the shooting, which itself is still to be fully explained, mm-hmm. there has been a dragnet in Southeast Queens by the police picking up young black men and trying to question them about what they know about any of the individuals who have been the victims of this attack.
Sure. My son Erskine Jr. happens to be friends with Trent Benefield, Joseph Guzman, and now the deceased Sean Bell. And the police officers are aware of that fact that he knows them. So on the morning of November 30th at 6 a.m., they came to my home under false pretense, supposedly saying that my son Erskine Jr. had an outstanding unpaid $25 summons. That was the impetus for them taking him, we thought, to the precinct. But later on, we came to realize that they didn't take him to the precinct at all. They held him in our parking lot, where we live at, from 6:30 in the morning until 8 a.m., questioning him about the shooting.
Did he try to call you at this time?
No, they didn't give him nothing. He just kept him in the car.
Have a lawyer?
No.
And what were they questioning him about?
What he knew about the shooting. Did he know of a fourth man? Could he possibly be the fourth man?
Was he at the party, at the bachelor party?
No. He was at home that night.
Were you wondering where he was?
Yes. We made several attempts to find out where he was at. We called the 113th precinct to no avail. We called the 103rd precinct to no avail. And the 105th precinct to no avail. Hence, later on, we found out after he called me about 2 o'clock that day saying they released him. He explained that when they finally took him to the 103rd precinct, when he was being questioned upstairs, a detective said to him, "Do you see that guy sitting next to you? How big his hands is? He'll put your effing head through that wall if you don't tell us what we want to know."
And there have been other people. In fact, there was actually a raid by police at 6 a.m. the previous morning in the same building, wasn't
yes.
there?
Yes.
Could you talk about that? What happened there?
Well, what happened was they said they had a tip from somebody. There was some drugs or something in the building. They're trying to build a case. They said that they had found a weapon and a small quantity of narcotics. Because they said there was a weapon that was supposedly involved in this incident, they're looking for everything. I think it's a witch hunt. I think they have, at best, no evidence. It's a tenuous case that they have right now. So they're doing what they can to try to build a case.
And you've also had an opportunity to talk to the 2 survivors of this shooting, the
yes.
wounded men, Trent Benefield and Joseph Guzman. And what have they been, I know their lawyers have said it, but if you could summarize for those of our listeners and viewers who haven't been following the case that closely, especially those in other parts of the country, what have the 2 survivors said happened to them that night?
Well, they said that they were leaving the club going to have breakfast at a nearby restaurant.
This is around 4 a.m.?
4 a.m. in the morning. And they said once they got in the car, they said the police officer, which was a black man, who came to the front of the vehicle with his weapon pointed at them, never identifying himself, with no badge displayed,
No uniform.
No uniform, plainclothes cop. They thought it was a carjacking of some sort. That explains why Sean panicked and was trying to get away from the man with a weapon.
Mm-hmm. And as he drives out, one of the police vehicles, the van, is turning the corner rapidly in the oncoming lane.
Right.
And they collide. They collide as he's pulling out of his parking spot.
Well, that's what we were told. That's the truth of the matter. Mm-hmm. But the way the police officer is trying to make it sound like that Sean ran into them.
It makes it sound like he hit a police officer knowingly and then the police car.
Which with the hitting police officer never happened. Trent was in the car and Joseph was in the car. And I spoke to both of them. That said that never occurred.
And then what happened?
Well, Joseph recounted to us how when he was in the car with Sean, who was driving, once Sean was hitting his neck by a bullet and he was bleeding profusely, his last words were when he looked at Joe, he said, "Joe, I love you." And Joseph leaned over and grabbed him and said, "I love you too, man." And Sean leaned back and died.
And Trent Benefield, who was in the back seat, actually was able to get out of the car, and he, and trying to run away from the shooting, he actually fell at the end of the block of Liverpool Street on 95th Avenue, right?
Just what you made mention of, Joseph said that that's what saved his life. Had it not been for Trent running from the vehicle, the police officers would have kept their weapons trained on him, and he'd probably be dead. But he said once Trent ran from the vehicle, the cops directed their attention toward Trent, and that saved Joseph's life, even though he was shot 17 times and have 19 holes in his body.
Let me read you a key part of the New York Times article on whether Sean Bell knew the undercover officers were actually police. Mm. It says, Lieutenant Napoli's account makes clear he believed the men in Mr. Bell's car knew he was a police officer because he had made eye contact with one of them. The report says Lieutenant Napoli could not articulate why he believed that. Mm-hmm. Lawyers representing Mr. Guzman and Mr. Benefield have declared that they had no idea the men they encountered that night on Liverpool Street were the police.
Mm-hmm. From what seems to have occurred regarding this Lieutenant Napoli, he don't have a clue what went on. He panicked when he heard gunshot. He thought he was being fired upon by them, and it was his own people that were shooting weapons. He don't know what happened. So his word has no real value.
We have to go to break, but we're going to come back to this discussion. We're speaking with Bishop Erskine Williams, Bishop of the New Seasons Family Worship Center and pastor to both the Benefield and Guzman families. His church, too, in Jamaica, Queens, not far from the nightclub where Sean Bell was gunned down. Stay with us.
Night is in the air. Enemy on the borderline. Who'll be the next to fire? 41 shots by Diallo side. You said he reached, sir, but he didn't have no peace, sir. But now he rests in peace, sir, in the belly of the beast, sir. You guys are vampires in the middle of the night, sucking on human blood. Is that your appetite? You said he reached, sir, but he didn't have no peace, sir. But now he rests in peace, sir, in the belly of the beast, sir. Have you ever been shot 41 times? Have you ever screamed and no one...
Wyclef Jean singing Diallo, referring to Amadou Diallo, who was gunned down by police, died in a hail of 41 bullets on February 4th, 1999, when I went to the funeral of Sean Bell in Jamaica, Queens. Following the casket was Amadou Diallo's mother, Kadiatou Diallo, among other parents, family members of those killed by police in New York. I'm Amy Goodman here with Juan Gonzalez. We've just broadcast exclusive footage, first-time Port Authority footage that Juan Gonzalez obtained of the air train, known as the train to the plane, the Port Authority train to Kennedy Airport, that showed that an errant bullet from the hail of 50 police bullets that ultimately killed Sean Bell hit the train tracks above, sending police and passengers scurrying, diving for cover. Bishop Erskine Williams is with us. His two sons were picked up in the days after the police shooting. In police raids, as the mayor, and you met with the mayor, yes. Bishop Williams, was saying excessive force was used. Yes. At the same time, these raids are taking place, not getting the same kind of coverage. Now, on the issue of the police that night, that morning, that Trent Benefield, Joseph Guzman, Sean Bell did not realize were police, explain what happened. Sean Bell, was he handcuffed even as he was near death when he was being put into the ambulance?
Bishop Lester Williams shared with us when they went to Jamaica Hospital that Sean Bell was in handcuffs. I didn't see Sean Bell because I didn't go that direction. Trent Benefield happens to live three or four doors from where I live, so he's my neighbor. Upon learning of the shooting through my son Saturday morning, I got up to see if I could be of any assistance to the family. So I took his mother, Denise, his grandmother, and his aunt to the hospital to see him. We were there at Mary Mackett Hospital for approximately an hour and a half before they let us upstairs. And I grew weary, and I asked Mr. Rubenstein, Sanford Rubenstein, why are we sitting here in this conference room if I came to pray for Trent and Joseph? So he said, I don't know, you have to ask detectives. And I went out and questioned one. I showed him my credentials. Why am I standing downstairs and they're upstairs? And he said, well, you have to speak to the inspector because I think that he's being questioned. I said, without an attorney? And he said, well, the inspector, who was Inspector Pearson, talked to me and said, well, we'll take you upstairs. I said, y'all have already broke the law by virtue of this shooting. Now you're adding insult to injury, questioning him without an attorney. So at that point, we were allowed to go upstairs, Reverend Al Sharpton, myself, Trent's mother, and his grandmother. That's when we beheld Trent laying in the bed with handcuffs on, his ankles and his hands. And I became irate. And I said to Inspector Pearson, where the hell do you think he's going? What do you think he's going to do? Why is he cuffed to the bed? So he said, well, it's departmental policy when we think there was a gun involved. I said, do yourself a favor. Leave the handcuffs on because I'd like Councilman Tom White to see these handcuffs. Within 5 to 7 minutes, the cuffs disappeared.
And it is clear, because I've reviewed the internal police, a copy of the internal police report, that they did question Benefield that night mm-hmm. in the hospital, and that he basically has said to the police then, the exact same thing that we've heard from his lawyers since then,
exactly.
That they had no idea that there was any that there were police, that a strange man came up to them with a gun. They tried to get away. He believes that they hit several cars as they were backing back and forth to try to get out of the situation. So his story then was the same story he has told ever since then. But the other thing about this is that there were other witnesses there. There was a young woman who was one of the people who worked in the bar by the name of Trini, who also spoke to police. And she said that in her testimony to the police that she saw a van coming around the corner, hit Sean Bell's car, and immediately after that, an officer from that van came out and began shooting. Now, she does not say in her testimony that it was another person, another individual on the street. She says that the shooting started from the person in the van. And of course, there are several other friends of Sean Bell who were in the bachelor party who were walking to their cars as well that mm-hmm. night, who about a total of five witnesses that a lawyer, Charlie King, is representing, who have all seen parts of this, of what happened that night. And several of them have been picked up by police in an attempt to find out what they know, and including the person who was wrongly identified as the, quote, fourth man,
Gene Nelson.
And Jean Nelson was at the scene, was a witness, was willing to cooperate. And my understanding is, in talking to Charlie King, that he was picked up by the police.
This is the attorney who ran for office.
The attorney who ran for state attorney general just this year in the Democratic primary, that Charlie King says that he was on a cell phone with Jean Nelson a couple of weeks ago when police picked him up on the street, picked Nelson up on the street, and that Charlie got on the phone with the police officer, said, "I am the attorney for Jean Nelson. Why are you picking him up?" And the police officer said, "I don't have to tell you that. I have my orders. We're taking him in." And he told him, "Well, on the cell phone, you are not to question him until I am there because I am his attorney." And of course, they proceeded to question him about the incident, what he knew. They held him for a couple of hours, and police officials later said that Jean Nelson had gone with them willingly to discuss the matter, and that as soon as the lawyer informed them, that they let him go. So there are all kinds of contradictions in this case.
Let's go to Mayor Bloomberg for one moment, a clip of what he had to say after the shooting.
Nobody takes this more seriously than Commissioner Kelly and I do. We are both very proud of our police department and the officers that work there. But I can't tell you that every time everyone does the right thing. And whether they did the right thing or not this time, it sounds to me like excessive force was used, but that's up to the district attorney to find out. And I do not want to prejudice their investigation.
That was Mayor Bloomberg. Bishop Williams, your response.
Well, I think that he was being fair in his assessment that the shooting was excessive. Anytime you have one police officer, namely this Mike Oliver, that fired 31 shots, it was mentioned to us in the police commissioner's statements at the meeting at the mayor's office that when they're trained, they're supposed to fire three rounds, assess the situation, fire three more rounds. That would say to me that he had to stop 10 times during this barrage of 31 shots, which we know didn't happen. Mike Oliver shooting 31 shots said to me clearly...
Mike Oliver was of the five officers, the white officer?
Right, and that's the racial element involved. A number of people is trying to say it's not race-related, and I beg to differ, because when you have three black men in a car and a white cop that discharges his weapon 31 times, and he has to stop at some point, discharge a magazine, and load another magazine in, the second magazine says to me there was an intent to execute and assassinate.
Well, interestingly, the official police report, again, that I've obtained a copy of and was able to review, shows that when the first police sergeant, Sergeant Wheeler, arrived on the scene, mm-hmm. And he had to question all of the officers as to whether they'd fired their guns. Mm-hmm. And Oliver actually said that he did not recall whether he had fired his
gun. Isn't that interesting?
Even though he's the only one who actually reloaded, emptied a magazine, reloaded, and fired again. But he supposedly told the arriving sergeant on the scene, I don't recall if I fired my gun.
In one of the many meetings I was in, it was mentioned to us by one law enforcement person that what was introduced into this whole scenario is that Mike Oliver is 9 months out of Iraq. So that might have attributed to him being trigger happy.
Well, and again, until we have the facts, we don't know if there was any real justification of whether they thought they saw a gun. And it is a difficult situation for police officers often on the street, but definitely 31 shots from one officer versus the remaining 19 shots from the other four shows that that particular officer certainly did the most damage in the shooting involved.
Let's talk about the climate right now in Jamaica. I want to play a clip of Reverend Al Sharpton talking about people's feelings. This is soon after the shooting.
At what point do you continue to fire, even reload, and not realize that no one is shooting at you? And to say that one gun causes an atmosphere where you keep shooting is to tell me and everyone that was sitting in that room that if one policeman makes a mistake, you could be subjected innocently to what could amount to a firing squad. That is no way to run a city.
That's right.
And that is no way to give comfort.
That's right.
We said to the mayor, we understand the crime problem. We understand because many of our communities have the worst crime problems. But imagine, Mr. Mayor, living in a city where you have to live with the fear of the cops and the robbers. Some in the city worry about the robbers. We have to worry about both. And that was the appeal that we made. This mayor has better manners than his predecessor. Let's see if we have better policy. We prefer talking than not talking. But the object is not a conversation. The object is fairness and justice. So is it better that he met than Giuliani didn't? Let's see what the results are. Because we're not just interested in being treated politely. We're interested in being treated fairly and rightly. And that will happen when police are held as accountable as anyone else. Lastly, there are those that are calling for peace and calm. The presence of peace is justice. Many are not calling for peace. They're calling for quiet. They want us to shut up and suffer in silence. If you want peace, you give justice. You don't tell people to shut up when they're hurting. You find out their pain, and you resolve the pain. And people wouldn't be hollering if they weren't in pain.
The Reverend Al Sharpton speaking outside City Hall. Bishop Erskine Williams, there's a major march planned for Saturday, December 16th. It's actually the fourth birthday of Jada, the older daughter of Sean Bell and Nicole Poultry. Sean, of course, who died in that hail of police bullets. You both, actually, Juan, as well, were at the 1199 meeting at the Union Hall of leaders planning this.
I think that Reverend Al Sharpton, as always, is doing a very commendable job. Had it not been for him the morning that the police officers invaded my home, 6 o'clock in the morning, he put me in touch with Charlie King, and Councilman Thomas White's office was very helpful. And Senator Malcolm Smith worked very, very valiantly in getting my son released. Reverend Sharpton is doing a tremendous job in getting attention where it's deserved when police officers are a law unto themselves. I believe for the most part, by and large, there's a lot of honest and decent police officers, but there's a culture within the culture that seems like that they do what they feel like doing. And that's why we have this death unnecessarily.
Well, one of the things the department has been saying quite a bit is that the actual number of shootings by police and the number of bullets used in shootings have been going steadily down. But at the same time, there's reports that the number of civilian complaints about improper use of force by police or discourtesy by police has been on the sharp increase. Mm-hmm. And in fact, apparently a report just came out this week that 60% of all the complaints are coming from African Americans, that there seems to be a real problem, with, especially within the African American community, and continually in relations with police in recent years.
I would attribute that to what I've always believed. What the police officers have written on the side of their car, courtesy, professionalism, and respect, has a dual connotation. It means one thing in middle-class and upper-class neighborhoods and something else in our neighborhoods. So they operate based on their own guidelines, not departmental policies.
And we just should say this conversation is taking place the night after, well, this from the Associated Press. Police said they shot and killed an armed man after he tried to run away from uniform officers, then tussled with them in a building lobby Wednesday night in the Bronx. Police said they found the man was carrying a semi-automatic gun, but only officers fired. Witnesses reported police shot the man four times at close range. One eyewitness, Hector Suarez, said the police officer stood over his head. He just looked down at him, and he just shot four times, 1, 2, 3, 4. There is a march planned for Saturday. Can you talk about what the plans are?
Yes, we're going to be mobilizing at 59th Street and 5th Avenue, marching down to 34th Street and 5th Avenue, to send a message to the city of New York that the black community is outraged by the truculent behavior of some in the police department. And it's not going to be tolerated no more. It's sad to say that we were of the opinion that we were developing a pretty fair and decent relationship with the police department. Hence, we're set back now, believing we haven't come not too far since the days of Amadou Diallo. I'm reminding of a shooting that took place back around 1973 when this racist police officer named Thomas Shea shot down a 10-year-old kid, Clifford Glover. This smacks of the same type of disregard for the black community. And I recall the response the community gave at that time. They took to the streets, and they clearly demonstrated it won't be tolerated no more. I'm in a very difficult position in that as clergy in the neighborhood, we're pleading for calm. But the neighborhood is starting to say, Reverend, how calm can we be? Black blood is not cheap.
Now, at the meeting at 1199, where leaders from around the community gathered to plan this march, mm-hmm. your second son was taken while you
at
were inside time, the meeting?
At that time. While we were in the meeting, I had my phones on vibrator. When I left the building, of course, I reached for my phone to see who's calling. When I retrieved the messages, I had a message from a lieutenant in the internal affairs who I had met consequently, when my first son was arrested. He was one of the people questioning him. And I really shared some concrete information with them regarding their lack of interpersonal relational skills. And I think thereby they told him, because he's black, interestingly, to call me and assure me this arrest was unrelated to the other stuff going on. If, in fact, it was unrelated, then why would you be questioning him about the shooting? I mean, I said to my colleague that was with me, do we need Hooked on Phonics to understand what's going on? I mean, for you to say it's unrelated, but you're going to question him about the shooting, and my godson was with him, Terry McKenzie, the police officers need him in his stomach.
Need him.
Need Terry in the stomach and beat him in his leg, and they asked him what he knew about the shooting, and when he said he didn't know anything, they took him down and accused him of trying to peddle drugs.
Well, that's going to wrap up our discussion now. We will certainly follow the march this Saturday, December 16th in New York City. I want to thank you, Bishop Erskine Williams, for joining us, Bishop of the New Seasons Family Worship Center and pastor for the Trent Benefield and Joseph Guzman families, the two men who were also shot by New York police the morning that Sean Bell was killed. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org. Back in a minute.
Solo voy con mi pena, sola va mi condena. Correré mi destino para burlar la ley. Perdido en el corazón de la grande Babilón. Me dicen el clandestino por no llevar papel. Pa' una ciudad del norte yo me fui a trabajar. Mi vida la dejé entre Ceuta y Gibraltar. Soy una raya en el mar, fantasma en la ciudad. Mi vida va prohibida, dice la autoridad. Solo voy con mi pena, sola va mi condena. Correré mi destino por no llevar papel. Perdido en el corazón de la grande Babilón. Me dicen el clandestino, yo soy el quiebra ley. Mano negra clandestina, peruano clandestino, africano clandestino, marihuana ilegal.
Manu Chao, clandestino, here on Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez.
At least 1,280 workers have been arrested in a series of immigration raids targeting meatpacking plants owned by the company Swift. The raids took place in Colorado, Nebraska, Texas, Utah, Iowa, and Minnesota. It marks the largest sweep of its kind ever against a single company. Homeland Security Chief Michael Chertoff justified the raids, saying many of the detained men and women were using false or stolen identities. The United Food and Commercial Workers International Union has filed an emergency lawsuit in an effort to release the workers who say they were illegally detained and are being held without access to legal counsel.
In Iowa, immigration lawyers have accused the federal government of holding the arrested workers at the military site Camp Dodge near Des Moines. Joining us in the studio in St. Paul, Minnesota, is Mariana Espinosa. He is the executive director of the Minnesota Immigration Freedom Network, the group's working with communities in Worthington, Minnesota. Three guests also join us on the telephone. From Colorado, where the meatpacking company Swift is based, Sylvia Martinez, a leader of the community group Latinos Unidos in Greeley, Colorado. Kim Salinas is with us, immigration rights attorney, who was inside an immigration detention center all day yesterday trying to meet with some of the detained workers. And on the line with us from Washington, D.C., where we'll begin, is Jim Papien, spokesperson for the United Food and Commercial Workers Union. Can you explain the scope of these raids? How did they go down, Jim?
Yes. On Tuesday morning, 13,000 workers kissed their spouses goodbye. They fixed the lunches for their kids. They took transportation into their meatpacking plants where they've been working, and they began doing their job. Shortly after that, in the early dawn, in many of those plants, ICE agents surrounded the plants, stormed into the plant, locked the gate, locked the plant, dressed in riot gear and with military weapons in some of these plants, you know, jumped on tables, began segregating and hurting people, terrorizing, 13,000 folks, terrorizing and criminalizing essentially 13,000 people who'd gone in to do their work that day. Subsequent to that, they began interviewing and detaining people, and then eventually shipping them out to distant cities and to other states. Now, why did they do this? Well, they went into a federal court, and they got a warrant. They said that there had been some identity theft. People were, in effect, stealing Social Security numbers from other people, and then using those in terms of their I-9 regulation to gain employment. So, what the ICE agents did was say, we've got 170 folks that we suspect of identity theft, but what we're really going to do is we're going to terrorize 13,000 people. We're going to separate parents from children. Children are left in school. Children were left in schools that day. No one there to pick them up. If you see the headlines from around the country, you'll see from the Des Moines Register, it says a breastfeeding mother missing in raid. A Utah headline, families ripped apart. Communities are ripped apart. To essentially go in and interview 170 people. Now, these plants have HR departments. There is a process for identifying folks, for bringing them in for interviews if that's necessary, and for the ICE agents to make their determinations. But what the government chose to do in this case was to engage in an act that really can't be described other than, terrorizing an entire workforce. So I think that's, in a nutshell, I think that sums up what happened on that day.
And how many people were actually detained as suspected of being in the country illegally?
Well, I think that 62 people, I think, were detained for identity theft violations. And I believe somewhere around 1,200 were detained for being here without proper status.
Mariana Espinosa, you're in the St. Paul studio, executive director of Minnesota Immigration Freedom Network. Talk about what's happened in your community.
Good morning to all. Well, it's a sad day today for the immigrant community here, and it's a human tragedy. American children are left without their parents, their brothers, and their sisters, and we are just trying to figure out how to help the community right now. I just want to make sure that it's clear. We need to stop this. America is using the excuse of being a national laws to criminalize those workers. None of the 230 plus workers being detained right now are charged with identity theft. So this is just an excuse to terrorize our community, to divide our families. And why do we need to have this situation right now on the 12th of December, a very, very important date for our communities in Latin America? And why we have to do this to children before Christmas, before the end of the year, where every year we celebrate our families? We need to stop this. This is not right, and this is a shame for this country.
I'd like to bring in Silvia Martinez from Latinos Unidos in Colorado. Some of the reports that I heard yesterday said that there were numerous cases of children of some of these workers in the plants who ended up school officials at the end of school had no one to pick them up, and many children in some parts of the country spent hours and hours after school as officials tried to figure out who or what family members could be located to pick them up. Could you talk about that or the impact in Colorado as well?
Well, it's a huge impact on children, absolutely, and on families as a whole. There were definitely children. There are definitely children without parents. A lot of these families were comprised of single parent households, and so yes, there are children. What happened is after school, they ended up, these children who did not have a mother or a father or mother and father to go to, they ended up with neighbors, with uncles, with aunts, that sort of situation. We're thinking, trying to calculate specifically, it's pretty difficult because there are still a lot of people not willing to come forward for fear that social services might get involved and take these children and, you know, pull them apart, not willing to come forward. But we have an estimate of about 100 children that are without parents right now, that are with neighbors and friends.
Kim Salinas, you're an immigration rights attorney. You spent the day in the detention centers in Greeley, Colorado. Can you describe who you found there, what you were telling people?
Sure. And I mean, I just wanted to kind of pick up on what the first speaker said about this being an act of terrorism. And in fact, it is, that the choice of one of the holiest days in Mexico was no accident. And not only were the 1,300 people, that were arrested terrorized, but the entire community has been terrorized. And that continues in that people still don't know where their family members are. ICE is not giving out any information about these people. Locally, we estimate 300 people missing. We don't have any lists about exactly who those people are. We have no idea where those people are. We've been told that they're between four or five different facilities, including county jails, a federal facility, and the immigration jail. We went yesterday to the immigration detention facility with a pro bono project that works in detention facility to try to give some Know Your Rights presentations to the detainees kind of give them an evaluation of their case. And we saw 12 people. After we spent the entire afternoon there, we were only allowed to see 12 people. While we were there, the director of the pro bono project heard that there were some buses out back. She went out to investigate. People were signing were being given their own deportation to sign on those buses. And we protested and said, hey, here we are, a bunch of bilingual attorneys here to give free legal advice. Let us advise these people before you have them sign their own deportation. And we were denied that opportunity to go back and advise these people of their rights. They've set up they have a toll-free number that they say families can call to find out where their family members are, but in fact the only thing they'll tell you on that toll-free number is the name of the person and the state they're arrested in. They give absolutely no information about where these people are.
Kim Salinas, I heard ICE Commissioner Julie Myers say last night that the SWIFT company had been very cooperative in the entire process on this. Have you had any contact with the management of SWIFT and had any sense that the company knew this was happening?
I haven't had any contact with the SWIFT company, but the whole identity theft sort of cover gives a really easy out to SWIFT. I mean, SWIFT can then just say, well, gee whiz, we were duped by these bad people who were stealing the identity of U.S. citizens, and we were really just trying to comply with the laws, and it definitely gives SWIFT an out. And obviously they're not really looking for people who are committing identity theft because they're not going after people who are making and selling false identification. They were after terrorizing the Latino and the immigrant community.
Mariano Espinosa in St. Paul and Worthington, the community, how were you able to reach out to the community? Was there Spanish language newspaper, television?
Yeah, it was very, very difficult to communicate with people and with the families here. Just to give you an idea, Worthington is located about 3.5 or 4 hours from the Twin Cities. We don't have a Latino radio station working 24 hours a day. We don't have Latino newspapers. So it was difficult. There was not a communication line open to the public. Working, we needed to work with one of the English radio stations to make something happen, but it was only after 7 p.m., so it was really difficult. But members of the UFCW and the president of the UFC, the local UFCW there, was able to be in the SWIFT. So that's how we got the first calls. And after that, it was, yes, a very chaotic situation because the word was spread really quickly. But within hours, the families were trying to hide instead of trying to communicate, because it's a very, right now, it's a very isolated population. It's only 12,000 people. It's in the middle of nowhere. So basically, the federal agents blocked some rats, and it was, everybody knew that immigration was there. So it was a communication, like talking to cell by cell and trying to just inform the neighbor next door to you about the situation.
And Mariano, I'd like to ask you, in terms of the importance of the Latino community to the meat plant there in your community, and how important the plant is to the Latino community there.
Yeah, the SWIFT right now here employs about 25% of the entire population in Worthington, Minnesota. This is the number one employer in the southwestern part of the state. It's a $2 billion company. So there's going to be an effect. There's going to be, no doubt, an impact in the economy. But basically, we already know that some community members need money to pay rent, and we know that some don't have any place to go. So we really need to think about how this immigrant community, the Latino community in Worthington, Minnesota, has brought life to the community. And right now, we don't know what is going to happen, not just to the Latino community, but how this is going to affect businesses, how this is going to affect people in other communities.
Mariano, we're going to have to leave. We're going to have to leave it there. But Mariano Espinosa of the Minnesota Immigration Freedom Network, Sylvia Martinez, leader of Latinos Unidos, Kim Salinas, immigrant rights attorney, Greeley, Colorado, Jim Papian of the United Food and Commercial Workers Union. I want to thank you all for being there. I want to say that we did call the Department of Homeland Security. They refused to come on with us, but we will certainly continue to follow this story. As we wrap up today, tomorrow at 9 o'clock, I'll be on C-SPAN with Brian Lamb, who's coming to New York at 9 Eastern Standard Time. And also, today is the last day we will be broadcasting from these studios, although we will remain in the DCTV, Downtown Community Television. We're just going to the third floor. We're moving on up. And that does it for the broadcast, Democracy Now!, produced by Sharif Abdo-Qudus, Mike Burke, John Hamilton, Elizabeth Press, Yoruba Rich and Aaron Maté, Lee Burek, Jen Utes, Mike DeFilippo, and Nick Marsilio, our engineers. Our website, democracynow.org. I'm Amy Goodman Juan Gonzalez. Thanks for joining us.